Hello and welcome to the Master of Demon Gorge podcast. Today we're talking about King Zhuan Xu. Today let's step into the mists of time, into the deep past. Which is to say, today let's talk about what isn't so much history as myth. The events and personalities we're going to describe below were not contemporaneously recorded, if they were real. They were rather written about by posterity many centuries later in the relatively recent periods of spring and autumn and warring states, or even practically yesterday during the Han Dynasty, or even the North and South Dynasties, as late as the 6th century AD. But in any event, there's one specific figure I want to talk about today, and there's a reason for it. We'll get to the reason before the end of this episode. The person I want to talk about is Zhuan Xu, the second of the so-called five emperors of China's deep past. We've talked about the first of the five emperors before. The Yellow Emperor was the mythic founder of China. He's been dated to around 2700 BC, again, if he was real, and he was said to have consolidated the northern tribes into an alliance. Then he led them in a war against the leader of the south, Chi You. Defeating him, the Yellow Emperor united north and south, forming a grand coalition of tribes that coalesced into the future Chinese nation, or people, or entity, or civilization, whatever you prefer to call it. Now this Zhuan Xu, whom I want to talk about today, was the Yellow Emperor's grandson. I'm going to try to combine, as best as I can, the sometimes contradictory accounts provided by different sources, such as the historical records of Sima Qian and the false book of documents, Shang Shu. But basically, the story goes like this. The Yellow Emperor had 25 sons, but only two of them were born to his principal wife, his queen, Luo Zu. The elder of these two was named Xuanxiao, or more commonly, Shao Hao, and the younger was named Chang Yi. Both sons were given fiefdoms, or tribes within the coalition, to lead. And later, the elder son, Shao Hao, succeeded the Yellow Emperor as the grand leader of all the tribes, although he is not listed among the five emperors of old. One version of the story, recorded by the geographer Li Daoyuan, who lived in the 5th and 6th centuries AD, says that the second son, Chang Yi, was bad, or at least was not good enough to succeed to leadership position, and that was why he was demoted to being a mere lord of a fiefdom. But this is a story found in only one source, and obviously a late source, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because under primogeniture, the elder son would inherit anyway. In any case, the second son, Chang Yi, then had a son of his own, named Zhuan Xu. One legend says that his wife became pregnant after seeing the light of the night stars pierce the moon like a rainbow. Sounds to me like maybe she saw the northern lights. Unusual at northern China's latitudes, but possible in a year of high solar activity. Anyway, so Zhuan Xu was born, and he is the protagonist of today's story. Zhuan Xu apparently worked with his uncle, Shao Hao, the leader of all the tribes, rather than with his father, the provincial lord. His uncle was apparently happy enough with him that he made him his heir. But when Shao Hao died, young Duan Xu turned out not to enjoy a smooth path to the throne. Another figure, Gong Gong, who was said to be a son of the god of fire, competed against Duan Xu for leadership. Or it may be that Gong Gong was really the name of a tribe. For that matter, Duan Xu might also be a tribe or a collection of tribes. And the conflict was really between two sets of tribes for the leadership of the grand coalition of all the tribes. A myth says that the two sides of the power struggle fought a grand battle. Naturally, a number of clearly mythical figures were involved. We're talking about, for example, Tai Feng, who was mostly human in form, but had the tail of a tiger, and Ji Meng, who also had a humanoid body, but the head of a dragon, and was thought to be a rain god. Actually, some have depicted Gong Gong himself as having the head of a man, but the body of a great serpent. An anaconda, maybe. In any event, through the terrible slaughter, Duan Xu's side gradually gained the upper hand. Gong Gong found his followers dwindling around him until the battle was clearly lost. In his terrible rage, he charged against the mountain called Buzhou Shan, Mount Buzhou, smashing into it so hard that he broke it. Some believe that Buzhou Shan was the ancient name the Chinese had for the Pamir Mountains, stretching from Tajikistan to Pakistan. Although in later centuries, the Pamir Mountains would be called Chongling, or the Onion Mountain Range in Chinese. Whether or not it was the Pamir, this mountain, according to myth, was actually one of the pillars of the earth that held up the sky. Because at this time, Gong Gong broke the pillar, it caused this corner of the sky to fall, and a massive flood fell from this corner. This then necessitated the goddess Nüwa to come and patch up the sky, in another one of the most important myths of ancient China. By patching up the sky, Nüwa saved the world. But she did an imperfect job, leaving an asymmetry in heaven and earth. And this, mythology says, is why we have seasons. And the continued tilt is why all the rivers in China flow from west to east. Anyway, back to Duan Xu. So he won this power struggle, and he became number two in the designated series of five emperors. Tradition tells us that Duan Xu then followed the example of his grandfather, the Yellow Emperor, and was a good ruler. Wherever he went, the people welcomed him. And he expanded the area under the control of the Chinese tribes. The historical records tells us that his rule extended as far north as what is now southern Manchuria, as far south as possibly Vietnam, as far west as the flowing sands, i.e. what is now the province of Gansu and the beginning of the deserts of Xinjiang or the Gobi, and as far east as the Pacific Ocean. If so, then he already ruled over more or less what we would come to think of, for most of Chinese history, as China. But of course, these are myths, so we have to take them with a grain of salt. There was undoubtedly a degree of positive image making in claiming that he was applauded everywhere he went. And if the Chinese tribes really extended so much under his reign, then such expansion must have involved a fair degree of violence. Tradition tells us that Zhuan Shi did a number of other notable things during his reign. He is said to have created the ancient Chinese calendar, which was actually called Zhuan Shi Li, or the calendar of Zhuan Shi. Or, put another way, the calendar that was in use by the Qing dynasty in the 3rd century BC and into the Han dynasty in the 2nd century BC was called the calendar of Zhuan Shi and was attributed to him. It was not until the reign of Emperor Wu Di of Han when they decided to reform the calendar, implementing a new one in 104 BC. Interestingly, only a few decades out from the creation of the Julian calendar in Rome. Another interpretation is that Zhuan Shi was really a mythical figure representing the sun. His various names, including the characters Zhuan and Shi, are all derived from characters relating to the sun. So the ancient calendar of Zhuan Shi was a solar calendar, different from the subsequent Chinese calendars. Tradition also tells us that Zhuan Shi composed a song called Cheng Yun, or Receiving the Clouds. Now, you may be wondering why, of all things, it's considered notable that Zhuan Shi once wrote a song. The reason, and it's related to the reason I wanted to talk about him today, is that music was closely associated with the worship of the gods in ancient China. In fact, the equivalent term they had for religion in the deep past was Li Yue, literally rituals and music. Confucius would later go on and on about rituals and music. They are a centerpiece of Confucianism. Because it wasn't just about rituals and music, it was about the proper practice of religion. Before you start thinking that understanding religion as merely a series of rituals and music could seem shallow or almost silly, let me remind you that Christian church services can be very accurately described as rituals and music. You come in, the priest or pastor says some standardized words and makes some standardized gestures in Latin, if it's a Catholic mass, and then the organ plays, the choir sings, and the congregation sings as well. If aliens came to Earth and observed a Christian service, they may well report back that they saw human beings engage in rituals and music. From another perspective, consider, the law as a concept is in many ways about the correct performance of certain rituals. We even have this term, due process. In U.S. constitutional law, we say that a person's procedural due process has been violated if the actors involved failed to perform the legally required gestures. The famed legal scholar Robert Cover once wrote a seminal paper called Violence and the Word, in which he pointed out that the difference between a crime and legally sanctioned state violence, the difference between homicide and the death penalty, is simply the observance of the correct legal process. In other words, the performance of rituals. Anyway, so Zhuan Shi wrote this song for the purpose of worship. He wrote a hymn. Actually, it was specifically to worship Shang Di, the emperor above, which was what ancient shamanistic Chinese religion called God, and it is now how the Christian God has since been translated into Chinese. I've recently been reading a book by Professor Yu Yingshi, one of the great scholars of Chinese culture of the past century, who spent much of his career teaching at Princeton. And he talks about how in China of the deep past, the king was also the chief priest, much like how the Roman emperor was also Pontifex Maxima, or how the king or queen of England is also the head of the Anglican Church. The traditional notion actually continued through imperial times until the early 20th century, the idea that the emperor had to represent society in praying to heaven for a good harvest for the year. But in any event, it meant that a king like Zhuan Shi was also the top figure in a shamanistic priesthood, which the Chinese called the Wu. The priesthood actually represented the educated elites of ancient Chinese society, and they were meant to serve as the go-betweens between gods and mankind. Again, not unlike how the Catholic clergy is meant to mediate between God and humanity. Mythology tells us that, starting near the end of the reign of the Yellow Emperor and into Zhuan Xu's time, the southern tribes called Jiu Li, the ones who were formerly led by Chi Yu, grew obsessed with worshipping the gods and the demons. Every household of the Jiu Li tribes seemed to have its own Wu priest. And seemingly every day, they spent their time praying to the gods, rather than farming or doing other productive earthly activities. So Zhuan Xu issued a dramatic decree known as Jue Di Tian Tong to sever the communications between earth and heaven. Of course, he didn't actually order the severance of such communications. What he decreed instead was that the private communications with the gods through household priests were no longer permitted. Only the king himself, as Pontifex Maxima, would here on out have the authority to speak with divine beings. We can understand this as Zhuan Xu trying to get the people of his primitive society not to invest an unhealthy amount of time and energy in religion, not to take religion too seriously. A piece of advice that remains relevant to this day. Or we can understand the event as an effort to defend royal authority and its supernatural basis, the divine right of kings. I am once again reminded of Christianity. The Reformation began because Martin Luther argued for each Christian's personal relationship with God, while the Vatican insisted that proper worship could only be conducted through the intermediary of the Church. Professor Yu Yingshi accounts for the rise of Chinese philosophy in the Axial Age, during the Spring and Autumn and Warring States eras, as resulting from a return to this individualization of religious thought. After the Zhou Dynasty began to go downhill, so that the Zhou kings began to lose their moral authority, the great philosophers, starting with Confucius, began to argue that every individual had it within himself or herself the ability to reason, to philosophize, to contemplate the mysteries of the universe, and to commune with the divine. In other words, the rise of Chinese philosophy and subsequent thought and culture was a return to a form of Protestantism that King Zhuan Xu had tried to prevent many centuries earlier. The later Han Dynasty text, Huainanzi, put it this way. When the Zhou Dynasty weakened and the way of the true king was lost, the Confucians and the Moists lined the streets to debate, all espousing their own views. Note here that what on the surface says lined the streets can also be translated as fractured the way, the Dao, the eternal truth. So the different schools of thought now each took a distinct view of the eternal truth, fracturing what was once intuitively understood by the ancients. And that was the rise of philosophy. In so doing, Confucius and his cohort took power away from the previous shamanistic priesthood that focused on rituals and music. They built up a new intelligentsia, a new class of educated people who sought knowledge in reasoned and positivist terms, subject to verification and debate, even, one might say, science, and no longer mired in the religious obscurantism of the past. It was nothing less than an enlightenment. Back to Zhuan Xu for a moment, just to wrap up his story. The records tell us that Zhuan Xu ruled for 78 years, from the age of 20 to 98, when he finally died. That obviously strains credulity. It hardly seems likely that a man in the Neolithic age lived to 98 years old. So perhaps this is again just a myth. That being said, we should remember that many of the ancient Chinese rulers, down to the Western Zhou dynasty, supposedly lived to tremendous age. On this podcast, we've previously talked about King Mu of Zhou, who ruled in the 10th century BC. He is supposed to have lived to the age of 104. Later Chinese emperors actually took note of this fact and wondered aloud why it was that the ancients apparently lived longer than people in their own times. From our modern perspective, it seems to me we can either surmise that the traditional accounts cannot be relied upon for such numbers, or we can surmise that people in China's deep past really did live longer, at least once they survived to adolescence or beyond. If you're of the latter opinion, well, I suppose this is why some people are into paleo diets. I have also come across recent scholarly arguments. For example, in the 2021 book, The Dawn of Everything, that the agricultural revolution actually shortened human lifespans. Before the agricultural revolution, people had varied diets. After it, people mostly ate the one staple that their part of the world produced, be it millet or rice or wheat. And that is bad for your health. Urbanization and settled society also meant epidemics and worse hygiene. That nomads going from pasture to pasture didn't need to worry about. So, go figure. Zhuan Xu had a son named Chong Chan, who would turn out to be a great-great-grandfather of the wise king Shun. But Chong Chan didn't succeed Zhuan Xu to the throne. Remember, Zhuan Xu had come to power by first serving as a lieutenant of his uncle, Shao Hao, before succeeding him. So when Zhuan Xu died, apparently at 98, his successor was a grandson of Shao Hao, named Di Ku. Although we should know that Di simply means emperor, so Di Ku was really just named Ku, even though we usually say his name together with his title. And Di Ku was the third of the so-called five emperors of China's deep past. But his will be a story for another time. This has been MODG. Thank you for listening.